So now we wait for my computer to react.
Before they start, I just wanted to thank you for your online presentation to Kolkata.
Oh, you're welcome.
That you gave on the Technology Enhanced Learning Conference.
Thank you.
Kinship gave.
Okay, I'm going to be brief because I have 10 minutes, so I don't want to go on for a long time. But I do want to introduce a few things. George Siemens and I, of course, developed the first MOOC back in 2008. Dave Cormier, who's here, was also involved with that. And what we did back then is we created a MOOC as a network. And this is actually a picture of what the first one looked like. This was drawn by Matthias Melcher, who was participating in the course. And as you can see, it does look like a bit of a mess. But that's good. In the time in between then and now, it's 8 years ago, right? We delivered a bunch of MOOCs. It's because that microphone is also on. I'm standing as far away from it as I can. But if we could somehow...
Oh, okay.
Just shut it off. Or something. It's pointed straight at me. So,
it's not a gun.
Yes, it is. It's a mic gun. There we go. I'm just going to do that. There we go. This might be better. This is my natural speaking voice anyways. So, we did a bunch of MOOCs. We did MOOCs on a variety of topics, and I won't list them all, but as time went by, and this was even in the seeds of the first MOOC, the idea of the personal learning experience became more and more important. And up until very recently, I was leading a project for the National Research Council to develop personal learning environments. Now, there's all kinds of reasons why I'm not doing that anymore, but I won't get into that. But the core concept, although it's very hard to sell, as I've discovered, nonetheless remains, I think, really important. So, but let's back up a bit, because we're busy evaluating MOOCs and we haven't even defined them yet. And I think that's a bit of a concern. I look at them as this. They're massive, but they're massive is not an achievement term, right? Massive is the way it was designed. And what happened was we designed our original course in such a way that when we got 2,200 people, we didn't have to close the course. The design of the course made it possible to have large numbers of people. So it's not whether or not you have large numbers of people, it's whether you use the appropriate design. Open. We were very, very insistent on openness. Again, there were several aspects here. We used open educational resources for the content of the course. We, instead of making a bunch of content ahead of time, we gathered stuff from around the internet. We made a few things. We encouraged participants to make things, etc. And that was one of the keys that made a massive course possible. Open means gratis, means free. If you're charging money for a MOOC, it's not a MOOC. I'm sorry. If you're charging money for a MOOC, it's not a MOOC. Online. Online is part of open. Online is a way of making it accessible to everybody in the world. I consider a MOOC that is delivered in person, as in, say, blended learning, to contain a limiting element, because you've restricted access to that MOOC to people who are able to attend the session in person. In other words, people who are local to that MOOC. So if it's blended learning, it's not a MOOC. And finally, courses. There's a definition of courses, it was in some of the literature, that quotes me that is sort of partly right. And what we meant by a course is something that begins and something that ends, true, that has a bunch of stuff in the middle, kind of sort of on the same topic. It doesn't necessarily mean an ordered presentation of material. And when we launched the MOOC, it was to use the sense of course in the traditional sense, where it wasn't a course with learning objectives and tests and essays and things like that, but rather it was a course as in a series of lectures or a series of presentations, not ordered necessarily, but one following the other. So that's what we meant by course. Okay. Want to now look at what's happened since then, and what's happened since then, of course, is the creation of the XMOOC. The XMOOC is a step back from the CMOOC. It's a step back toward traditional learning, right? And it is based in content, is based in assignments typically. It is the sort of thing that is accredited and certified. This is not what we were after originally. And, you know, it's like, you know, when people invented moving pictures for the first time, they presented stage plays because that's what they understood. It's the same sort of thing. And we have all of this technology. We have the capacity to create large networks of interconnected people studying and learning about a topic together or individually, however they want. And we went back into this thing that actually eliminated all of that, which was disappointing. But let me capture this distinction in a way that I hope is intuitive and understandable. Just as an aside, I asked Dave yesterday why everybody loves George Siemens so much. And because, you know, it's like George and me, right? And everybody may have. And he said, George has a way of convincing people so that everybody in the room, when he talks about something, everybody in the room leaves the room thinking, yeah, he's right, agreeing with George. I have the opposite effect. But I try. Okay. There's two approaches to learning. One is based on content. The other is based on practice. One is based on there is this domain that you are trying to learn about. The other, a much more informal method, is based on I'm trying to get something done, trying to solve a problem, do a project, something like that. Right? So the content-based approach begins with content, and then there might be some practice at the end. The practice-based approach begins with practice. You're trying to do something, and then there's a result of that, which is content. And that's what you're seeing here, right? You're going to see some content at the end of this short talk. So, I hope I didn't go too fast here.
Stephen, I really like you, but you're standing in front of the button.
Sorry about that. I'm trying to stand in the right place.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's
there. Am I good now? Okay, and if you're watching on the video sometime in the future, hi, future people! if I'm now off the screen, sorry. So notice the difference between the two. The content-based approach defines some kind of ideal state that everybody must have at the end of this, whereas the practice-based approach defines a desired state, an individual personal objective that you're trying to satisfy. The one is defined by the provider of the course, the other is defined by the person taking the course. In the content approach, after the practice, well, the practice is a test to see if you are worthy, right? And the person involved in the course, instructor, facilitator, whatever, will test you. Compare that to the practice-based approach where the content is the result of you trying. You tried to do something, here was the outcome. I threw a dart, I tried, it hit the wall, that was the outcome. It hitting the wall, that's the content. It's not very good content, but it's content. And the person there is there to help me. instead of to test me. So that moves us in both of these, we have a second iteration, right? In the content-based approach, the test will reveal a gap in your knowledge, maybe, and therefore you will be corrected and sent back to the beginning. That's your classic adaptive learning model, isn't it? It's also very similar to your classic educational model. On the other hand, here, each practice is an iteration. It's a process of learning iteratively. We keep trying, and each time we try, that creates another opportunity to learn. The content-based approach is like a library. Formal contents, chapters, linear progression. That's why I was objecting when somebody said I defined the course as linear. Right? Because, no, it's not linear. Right? But it's like a library. But a course that is based on practice is more like an environment, a dojo, a gymnasium, a lab, a workshop. Right? You see the totally different approaches. Personalized is that kind of model. XMOOCs is that kind of model, right? And for quite frankly, quality assessment is that kind of model, right? Personal, where we do things for ourselves, is this kind of model. Come on, click. Okay, so we have this distinction, personal versus personalized. It stopped working for me. Now, just a few words on the actual assessment of quality of one of these things. Now, I could have thrown about 8 slides in here, but I've only thrown 1. So, as was pointed out before, the anonymous quote, I love that. Most of what I've contributed to the field is anonymous, so you never see me in the citations, but it's there. The structure of the course is a network. A well-functioning course is a well-functioning network. Therefore, the quality of a course is the quality of the network, right? So what's a good network? Well, there's a bunch of conditions that I won't list. I'm going to focus in on what I call a semantic condition. But basically, a well-functioning network is one that can adapt and grow and change. A poorly functioning network is one that doesn't. One that is slow, is resistant to change, and eventually becomes static and unmoving, which we can call network death. And if you think about it, there are 2 states of network death. One where nothing is connected to anything else. Right? And so nothing changes because nothing is connected to anything else. And the other where everything is connected to everything else, so that a change in one immediately results in a change in all of them and nothing changes after that. So healthy networks are somewhere in between. And I remember when I first got into this, Francisco Varela talking about the connectivity of the immune system and giving us a slope and saying there's this sweet spot in network connectivity. And so the question of what is a successful network is, how do you hit that sweet spot? And like I said, there's a bunch of criteria. For the purposes of this group, and generally for educational purposes, because educators are so focused on the semantics, I have the semantic condition. 4 conditions. If you've heard me before, you've heard me talk about this. Autonomy, right? And people have already talked about autonomy. There's a bunch of different ways of defining autonomy. If autonomy isn't just you get to do whatever you want. There's autonomy of practice, autonomy of belief, autonomy of effect, so that your actions are meaningful, etc. Diversity, which is the flip side of autonomy. Massive isn't defined as diversity. whoever said that, that was wrong. See, this is why people leave the room thinking, I haven't seen, anyhow. diversity means multiple perspectives, right? It's hard to get multiple perspectives unless you're massive, but again, massive is something different than diversity. Multiple perspectives means not simply multiple cultures, multiple languages, but multiple points of view, multiple locations, multiple technological tools. So, yes, we will even accept iPhones, even if we don't want to. Don't think of them as real technology. Sorry, just kidding. openness, and this is what the money blocks, right, is openness. Openness means it allows signal to come into the network so that the network has something to adapt to. Openness means the possibility of communication within the network so that you're not blocked from talking to other people. And openness has to do with effect or output from the network so that the network doesn't just sit there and chug, but it can actually do something. And then finally, interactivity. And interactivity isn't just old school Moore type interactivity. Everyone loves Moore, but the world has moved on. Sorry, I had to say that. Interactivity isn't just the propagation of a signal from one entity to the next, where the content of the learning is the content of that signal. That's an information theoretic view of learning. Interactivity, from a network perspective, means that the content of the learning is derived as a consequence of the interactivity of the members, of the participants in the learning. So the interactivity itself does not contain the content. The content, as they say, emerges from or is emergent from the totality of the interactions. You might say that it is the pattern of communication that occurs in a network. And of course, I'm eliding many points here. Those are the four conditions, to my mind, of 4 points of the semantic condition, which is the core learning condition for a successfully functioning network. That's all I have to say, and I hope I didn't take too much from my time.
Any question, comment?
I agree with you when I walk out. Beautiful. Thank you.
That's one.
Okay. You have a question?
That was a great presentation, Stephen. I think you've contributed so much to the field.
Absolutely.
It's terrible if you're not being cited. My question is, it's around learners and in a MOOC, however we define a MOOC, we need people who are able to capitalize on the four different areas that you said, so the autonomy, the diversity, the richness, many learners and studies we've done have said they feel unable for whatever reason to capitalize on, to be able to have the confidence and the persistence to really contribute within these MOOCs. How do we enable people? I don't think people can be enabled, but how do we deal with this issue?
So the first thing I'm going to do is question the data, right? You're making some generalizations that are the result of, frankly, fairly traditional research methodology, and I question that methodology. I'm not sure you've captured the experience of taking a MOOC.
Exactly. Second, the same data here. Exactly the same problem with almost somebody. Just to echo.
Yeah.
Can I say, Stephen, that when we gathered the data, we found real diversity in the experience. So we had some people who were doing all of these things, and other people who somehow felt a bit intimidated by the people who were out there.
Well, we're going to talk about that, obviously. But, you're going to see some resistance from me. But we're not going to resolve that right now in this conversation. But You know, I mean, but I will say this. It's like advertising, right? You guys have set up expectations in people, right? And then you evaluate the product based on the expectations. And so when you go in with this research, you're saying, here are all these things this MOOC should have done for you. Did they do it? And, of course, the MOOC was never designed to do that, right? You're still doing the whole content-based, et cetera, kind of approach in your evaluation, right? A MOOC isn't intended to be a feel-good system for a person. It isn't intended to be a, I can list a bunch of things that you put on that. A MOOC is an environment, and what you make out of it isn't necessarily a property of the environment. What you make out of it may be a property of the other people in that environment. It may be a property of yourself. It may be a property of a whole bunch of things. But you're lumping this up and saying, this should be this educational experience that people walk away feeling really good about. And that wasn't the objective. That was never the objective. When George and I launched the first MOOC, our objective was to have this conversation about connectivism. And people could come along if they wanted. And it's turned into something where we're expected to be sages on the stage teaching people about connectivism. Never was the point. Sorry.
You are the culprit now.
Pardon?
You are the culprit now because the world has moved.
Yeah. It's still my fault. Yeah.
We'll give you credit for that.
Yeah. I think there are some assumptions there as to the evaluation. But I agree with you that the social norms around what people expect from a course have been transferred to a MOOC. So when you run something like a connectivist MOOC, some people get it. They get that idea they are producing content for others to learn, and they are learning from other people's content. But other people are taking these assumptions of formal learning into the MOOC.
Well, I know that. They're wrong.
So how do we advise the governments? What does future learning
Well, I think you should make some of these distinctions clear, right? You talk about MOOCs and quality for MOOCs, right? And then you say, well, we'll take these norms and apply it to that. We'll call that quality. And I think that's a ridiculous proposition. It's, massive open online learning is a new thing. And I don't think it's appropriate to evaluate it by old criteria. That's...
Yep.
See, I'm not George.
You are what you are.
Okay, so my video stopped recording at some point. But my audio might have succeeded. Yes.